Have you ever asked yourself the question, why is our lodge room laid out in the way it is? Or have you taken it so much for granted that such an idea has never occurred to you? Whichever is the case, this tape is meant to get you thinking afresh about some of the things that you see every time you meet. It will also help you to understand better some of the variations that you may see in other lodge rooms when you go visiting. For though much of the furniture in our lodges seems uniform, you will from time to time see things in your own or others' temples which tell you something about the way in which our present-day furniture came about. That's why this tape is called Getting to Know Your Lodge Room. Let's begin where any walk round a lodge should begin, at the entrance. In many lodges, the first thing that you may notice is two large pillars. Of course, the place where they stand can vary a great deal. In Exeter, in England, there is a lodge room which now has the two pillars outside the door of the lodge, mainly because they took up too much room when they were inside. In Bristol, in England, they stand just on the other side of the door, and there's someone standing by the pillars to ask you for the password as you seek to enter. In a lodge in Edinburgh, in Scotland, you would see the two pillars at the west end of the room, beside the two wardens who sit in the northwest and southwest positions, which we normally keep for the dinner table. And in Bath, England, there are two great pillars standing at the west end of the carpet, with a kneeling stool between them. And in many other lodges, the pillars flank the worshipful master's pedestal in the east. Why do we have these two great pillars, which are mentioned on the second tracing board? The earliest craft reference to two pillars is in the Cook manuscript of around 1410, where we read that they were made by Lamech's children in readiness for the destruction of the world. One of the pillars was made of marble, and the other of lateran, or bronze, because the first would not burn, and the other would float. This was important because these pillars were to contain all the sciences that men had found. And some other writers say that these pillars were made by Seth, and others that their maker was Enoch. The thing that may surprise you is that it's not until 1696 that there is reference to Solomon being the originator of the two great pillars. That occurs in what is called the Edinburgh Register House manuscript, which includes a catechism of 17 questions and answers. In these, we hear the question, where was the first lodge? And the answer, in the porch of Solomon's temple. And what strikes us also is that there is, from now on, not a single mention of those earlier pillars of Lamech. It seems likely, therefore, that when the admission ceremonies were shaped, or reshaped, to contain their allegorical link with Solomon's temple, the pillars at the porchway or entrance to it were adopted in place of the earlier pair, and so the latter were never restored. It was thus, at this early stage of ritual text development, that these two pillars became a regular part of the furnishings of a lodge room. And some of the earliest catechisms suggest that both pillars were named and referred to in the entered apprentice degree. They would, of course, first of all be drawn on the floor of the lodge in chalk or charcoal, and thus form the central design for what we now know as our traces. And by December 1733, the minutes of the old King's Arms Lodge No. 28 record the first step in that direction, with the purchase of a more permanent floor cloth. Between 1760 and 1765, we have evidence that the two wardens each had a column representing one of these pillars as part of his personal equipment when in lodge. By 1768, we read in the book three distinct knocks. The senior and junior warden have each of them a column in their hand, about 20 inches long, which represents the two columns of the porch at Solomon's Temple, Boaz and Jachin. Finally, the two pillars appear as handsome pieces of lodge furniture from 4 to 8 feet high, and usually in the western end of the room. Why, when so many lodges today still use such pillars as the entranceway to the lodge or a degree, there is so little mention of them in the 18th century inventories, may be due to the fact that these items belonged to the hall in which they met, and not to each lodge. In London, England, it's still true that they appear little as actual columns, but there they are on the fellowcraft tracing board, and in miniature on the warden's pedestals. When we look at these pillars, large or small, we may also notice that whilst the miniature columns on the warden's pedestals always have two globes, we call them one terrestrial and the other celestial, as do the pillars in many fellowcraft tracing boards, yet the free-standing pillars in lodge rooms either have nothing on the top of them, or, as is the case in Bath, England, have two bowls or half-globes at their head. Why is there this difference? And how did this come about? The explanation begins with a difficulty about the Hebrew words first used in the Bible to describe them. In 1 Kings chapter 7, verse 16, the word used in Hebrew is kothoroth, which meant chapiters, capitals, or even crowns. But in verse 41, without mention of any further works done, the text speaks of guloth hakathoroth, and here the word guloth is the problem. This can refer not only to balls or globes, but also to bowls or vessels that are round or spherical. It's thus clear that from the original text in Hebrew, we cannot say firmly that there is one interpretation that supersedes all others. The pillars had crowns or heads, or they had bowls on top of them, or they had complete globes. In time, but only slowly, the headpieces to Solomon's pillars were accepted as being globes. One of the reasons why this happened as the more general development was because fewer and fewer lodges were able to possess what you can still see in All Souls Lodge, Weymouth, in Dorset, to this day. A handsome pair of globes, each mounted on a tripod base, standing left and right of the worshipful master. In the Lodge of Peace and Unity, number 314, at Preston in England, a pair of globes, also on low, three-legged stands, are seen a yard or two in front of the senior warden. When these globes, the mark of any learned gentleman's study or library in the 17th and 18th centuries, went out of fashion, or could not be procured, then they migrated as models to the top of pillars, whether on tracing boards or on the warden's pedestals. Walking into the centre of the lodge room, as we have now done, it may begin to strike us that whilst we have mentioned the two pillars at the porchway or entrance to King Solomon's temple, and seen their retention in some lodges only in the warden's places, those latter officers also have another pillar, or column, which carries a light or candlestick. With the column at the master's pedestal, we have entered upon that part of our symbolism which is contained in, but rarely heard from. I mean the first tracing board. Our lodges, we are told there, are supported by three great pillars. They are called wisdom, strength, and beauty. Wisdom to contrive, strength to support, and beauty to adorn. But as we have no noble orders in architecture known by the names of wisdom, strength, and beauty, we refer them to the three most celebrated, which are the Ionic, Doric, and Corinthian. As early as 1710, we have a question and answer section in rituals, called the Catechism, in which the answer three is most evident. Thus we have the query, are there any lights in your lodge? Yes, three. Are there any jewels in your lodge? Yes, three. How many pillars is in your lodge? Three. About 1727, the answer to this last question begins to be expanded to include the words three, wisdom, strength, and beauty. And by 1760, the pillars were allocated respectively to the worshipful master, the senior and junior wardens. Even so, it has to be remembered that these pillar questions belong to a period when there was still no general idea of turning the words into actual pieces of furniture in a lodge room. References to actual pillars are so rare as to be very easily noted. In 1757, the Nelson Lodge, and in 1761, the Lodge of Relief in Bury, both of these in Lancashire, England, are alone in having specific mention in their records of the purchase of such pillars for the three principal officers. The early 18th century Freemason would have looked in some astonishment at the handsomely furnished lodge room that you and I have today. There were no checkered carpets, no pedestals, and no special furnishings. In England, a copy of the old charges and a Bible were thought to be enough. What was an early innovation was the set of three candles. Indeed, it's likely that the floor drawing of the two great pillars were first illuminated by having three candles placed in the form of a triangle around them. They appear as early as 1696, and by 1730, we have a note to the question posed above about three lights in the lodge, which reads, "Note specially, these lights are three large candles placed on high candlesticks." And this note leads on to the next question, "Why so?" which is answered by the words, "Sun to rule the day, moon the night, and Master Mason his lodge." The first sense of a combination between the two sets of equipment, three pillars and three candlesticks, appears in the records of the old Dundee Lodge in Scotland in 1739. Still in use today, there were then purchased three candlesticks of elaborate design in the Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian styles. Yet by 1769, the Masonic author, Brother Hutchinson, describing the furnishing of a lodge, spoke at length about the three candles or lights, but still makes no mention whatsoever about three pillars. It was only towards the end of the 18th century when special Masonic lodge rooms or halls were being constructed for frequent and continuous use, that there was the natural and economic blending of the two sets of furniture. Three candlesticks, set on three pillars, each with their distinctive design, and each placed beside the appropriate officer. There are two other features of your lodge that you're bound to notice if you walk carefully around it. They are the rough and smooth ashlars. Their positions again vary a great deal from lodge to lodge, some having them on the warden's pedestals, some placing them at the foot of the pedestals, some placing them at the west end of the carpet, and some actually putting them where the candidates will stand for the charges in the northeast or southeast corners of the carpet. But how did these items come to us? In 1696, we are told that the three jewels of the lodge were the perpendicular, a square pavement, and a broad oval. And it has been suggested that this could have meant a dressed stone, a form of floor design, and a stone with a rough or indented surface. Certainly, by 1730, we have the immovable jewels as trestle board, rough ashlar, and broached thurnal, whose uses are trestle board for the master to draw his designs upon, rough ashlar for the fellow craft to try their jewels upon, and the broached thurnal for the entered apprentice to learn to work upon. This at last shows that two stones were somehow represented in the lodge room, whether as sketches on the floor or actual stone pieces on the floor drawing. From 1744 onwards, the French exposures of masonry begin to show the two stones clearly, but not in any fixed positions. It's true that the present ritual seems to suggest where the stones on the floor ought to be, but clearly there is not enough tradition to justify insistence on this point, and what you need to do is to be clear as to why your lodge places them where it does. If we are workers of emulation ritual, our walk so far around the lodge may have led us this way and that across the central carpet. If we work other rituals, we may well have followed our normal custom of walking squarely around the carpet. In either case, I wonder if we know from where the carpet comes. I have already pointed out that in the earlier days of English Freemasonry, there would have been no black and white checkered carpet, but probably only bare boards with a drawing on part of them. It was this fact, and the sets of floor cloths that followed the drawings, that led to the present idea of not walking across the central area of a lodge room. It's as if the old drawings, cloths, or tracing boards are still there, as indeed in Bristol, England, and elsewhere they still are. What is also evident is that in the earliest printed illustrations of tracing boards, there is always an area below or between the two great pillars, which is of a checkered pattern. It was therefore not at all surprising that when again the Masonic halls were being more tastefully and permanently furnished, the bare boards of earlier days should be covered with an appropriate and time-honoured mosaic pavement. The carpet as we know it had come to stay, and there was no need to draw on it or cover it, save with the tracing boards that had now also appeared. Thus we have made our first journey around the sort of lodge room with which we are now familiar. We hope that this introduction to your local room, and to others, with their treasures, will have encouraged you to look for and to learn more.